Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation. And this one is on vitamin B2. I'm excited to be here to share this information with you. This is Dr. Rita Marino-Scalzo. And before we get right into the presentation part, I just want to make sure that you're aware that anything that I present to you is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's certainly not intended as medical advice. It is intended as a sharing of my knowledge and my clinical experience to you. And what you do with that information is, if you are working with a client, that you are aware that when you're working with them, that they need to be working in conjunction with their medical practitioner if they're on any medications or they have a diagnosed condition, if they have that. And that you're not giving them medical advice, and that I'm not giving you medical advice. We're just educating and empowering. So we've got our vitamins at a glance chart, and where we're at right now is vitamin B2. As most of the vitamins, the B vitamins, they have other names. So for vitamin B2, it's riboflavin. You might also see it as riboflavin 5-phosphate, especially on certain supplements, certain high-quality supplements, because that's the active form. And what riboflavin is involved in is the production of energy. It's one of the Krebs cycle intermediates. We'll see where that lies. It's for the production of red blood cells. It actually works in conjunction with vitamin B12 and folate in the methylation pathways, and also has some role in vision. So let's jump in and take a look. So some general information about B2. It's also known as riboflavin, as I said, and it's water soluble. So as are all the B vitamins. And like most of the B vitamins, there's not a storage, like there's no place where excess gets stored. There's a certain amount in all the different tissues, and we'll look at where those are, but there's not like this pool. For example, like for B12, vitamin B12, there's a pool that's in the liver that can last, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 years. Not so with the other B vitamins. Vitamin B2 is one of those. So the word flavin in riboflavin comes from the Latin word flavus, which means yellow. And the vitamin gets its name from that because when you exceed what your body needs, your urine turns bright yellow. And most of you have probably seen that where you take B vitamins and then you find that a few hours later and for, you know, however long after that, several hours, every time you pee, it's this bright, like almost iridescent yellow. That's mostly from the riboflavin, the vitamin B2. As most of our vitamins, we'll find that there's some sort of a coenzyme function that goes along with it, meaning that they are catalysts for various and sundry metabolic pathways in the body that need a little bit of an extra boost. So they act as coenzymes. So the two coenzyme forms, which we'll go into in detail, are FAD, which stands for flavin adenine dinucleotide, and that's one of the Krebs cycle intermediates. And then FMN, which is flavin mononucleotide, which is also the riboflavin 5-phosphate form. So when we see this on a supplement bottle, we may see it listed as riboflavin 5-phosphate. So the coenzymes that are derived from riboflavin, we call them flavocoenzymes. So if you ever see that term, flavocoenzymes, you know that they are coenzyme forms of riboflavin. And then enzymes that use a flavocoenzyme are called flavoproteins. So the enzymes and the coenzymes. So the enzymes are called the flavocoenzymes, and those are the riboflavin-containing coenzymes. And then the enzymes themselves are proteins, and we call them flavoproteins. So here's the structure. It has a flavin ring. You might also see it as isoalloxazine. Some of these words are very challenging to say. They're derived from foreign languages, and I'm not a big foreign language aficionado as far as my skill set. So you might see me muck up a couple of those words here and there. So this is the specific structure. So that those rings at the bottom are called the flavin ring, and then sitting up off the top is the CH2, CHOH3. That's called the ribitol or sugar alcohol. So we've seen other kinds of sugar alcohols in different places like xylitol or erythritol. This is a sugar alcohol that's part of the riboflavin molecule called ribitol. Here's a comparison of the different coenzyme forms. On the left-hand side is FAD, the flavin adenine dinucleotide. And you can see it has that same ring, the flavin ring, but then you've got this ribitol kind of thing, and then these other pieces that sit on top of it, and you can see that there's a phosphate. There's actually a phosphate in there, okay? And then we have the FMN, the flavin mononucleotide, which similarly, and it just has that one phosphate group at the end, whereas the adenine diphosphate has more than that. It has a bunch of others. It has two phosphates because it's a dinucleotide, and then it has other rings attached to it. You don't need to know the chemical structure. It's just sometimes interesting to look at them and see that, you know, some minor differences, and also to kind of picture what's happening when we have carboxylases and decarboxylases and things that break down these various forms. So let's take a look at how riboflavin is absorbed in the body. It definitely requires some good stomach acid and enzymes in the stomach to cleave it away from its protein carrier. So the carrier like surrounds and attaches to either the riboflavin, FAD, or FMN, depending on the form that's in that particular food. And oftentimes there's multiple forms. It then requires intestinal enzymes called phosphokinases to convert it before it's absorbed. So there's an enzyme called FAD pyrophosphatase that converts the FAD to FMN, and then the FMN phosphatase converts the FMN to riboflavin, and then there's something called the nucleotide diphosphatase and then alkaline phosphatase, which takes the riboflavin phosphate to riboflavin. So we've got multiple forms, we've got multiple enzymes. And, you know, we think about the digestive tract, we think of it as replete with enzymes because we've got proteases and amylases and all these enzymes that digest food. But there's another group of enzymes in the intestinal tract that actually break the food down at a deeper level. They, you know, take phosphate groups off and do all sorts of other things to make interconnections to make the nutrients in the foods that we eat much more available for absorption. About 7% of the FAD is bound to monoamine oxidase and succinate dehydrogenase. Those won't be absorbed. So it's only about 7% that are generally not absorbed. It's a very high percentage that absorbed of riboflavin, unlike some of the other nutrients we've seen where only 25 to 50% may get absorbed. The way that riboflavin is absorbed is in the proximal small intestine, so the upper part of the small intestine, like the duodenum. It's actively transported through the lumen of the digestive tract into the cells, the epithelial cells there. And that's different than we think of the macronutrients because most of those are absorbed down in the jejunum. So riboflavin is absorbed much further up. And active transport means that there's a protein carrier in the wall that takes it and escorts it over across into the other side. And those are usually going to require, guess what? Energy, ATP. So that's why people with mitochondrial dysfunction, where they're not making enough ATP, or they're deprived of oxygen and they can't make efficiently go through the Krebs cycle, then those people will have impaired digestion and absorption of nutrients. So mitochondrial dysfunction affects every cell in the body. And in particular here with riboflavin, it's almost like a vicious cycle because if we have a mitochondrial dysfunction in the digestive tract and we don't have enough enzymes, we don't have enough ATP to get it efficiently absorbed, then we don't get the riboflavin into the system. And then riboflavin is required for the Krebs cycle and for making energy, right? So we have to have everything working in top-notch shape. When you take large doses of riboflavin, super physiologic doses or pharmacological doses, some passive diffusion occurs. And we see that in almost all of our nutrients, that at the normal amounts, it requires work for the body to pull from the intestinal tract into the cells. It requires work, and it has to do with gradients. So if there's more of something on one side of a membrane, then on the other, it has to be actively transported. But if there's a lot in the digestive lumen, And it can allow passive diffusion because it just passes through without an energy expenditure. And that's usually because of the gradient. So for most vitamins, riboflavin included, when we have large doses, we're going to see the passive diffusion. But this is really a kicker. On average, absorption of riboflavin from food is about 95%, up to approximately 25 milligrams. Once you get into those super physiologic doses, which a lot of the B complexes have, which is more like 50 or 100 even, then the absorption does go down. So you might be getting more on an absolute amount, but the percentage goes down. It's been found that the optimal absorption occurs somewhere between 15 and 20 milligrams of riboflavin. There are cases where we want to get more in there, if somebody has a severe deficiency, for example. But it really just plays to, we're not really seeing that much of an impact once we get over that 25 milligram dosing. What crosses the intestinal epithelium into the cells that line the digestive tract is the free form. So if we're eating food that has the FAD form or the active form, the riboflavin 5-phosphate, it actually has to get broken down inside the intestinal tract and then reabsorbed. And then we're going to see what happens after that. It's like, what is the body doing? Why does it keep breaking it down and putting it together and breaking it down and putting it together? So let's just see what that looks like. So riboflavin transport. Okay, we have the free form of riboflavin is absorbed into the intestinal epithelium, like I just said. So if you've got in the food, there's a combination of these forms, or if you're taking a supplement that's the riboflavin 5-phosphate form, then it's going to be broken down into riboflavin, and the riboflavin, along with the pieces that get broken off, get absorbed into the intestinal epithelium. And then once inside the mucosal cells, a process called phosphorylation puts the phosphates back on it and creates FMN. This reaction is catalyzed by an enzyme called flavonokinase, and it requires ATP. Okay, so we required ATP to get the free form riboflavin across into the cells. Now we need more ATP to actually take the phosphorus groups that had been taken off and put them back on. But the good news is that when we took the phosphorus groups off, then we released energy because there was stored energy in there. So then it's dephosphorylated to riboflavin at the bloodstream. So you figure out these little membranes. So first you've got the opening, the lumen of the digestive tract, and we've got the membrane between the lumen and the intestinal epithelial cells. So it goes into free form to get through there. Then once in there, it gets put back into its phosphorylated form, and it does whatever it does in there, and then it has to go across and get into the circulation. And so once it's going to move from those cells into the bloodstream, then it's dephosphorylated again. It's broken down again to the free form. It goes into the portal circulation, and it goes to the liver. And then in the liver, it's converted back to the FMN and the FAD, the phosphorylated forms, by an enzyme called flavokinase. So it seems like what's going on here? And I think part of it has to do with once the riboflavin is absorbed into those intestinal epithelial cells, it actually does some work in there. It's not like all of it gets put into the bloodstream to be circulated. Those cells become nourished. Only thing I can think of. And there's also, this brings up the issue of, well, if what's the point of taking a phosphorylated form or an active form if the body's going to break it down anyway? And this is true of, say, vitamin B6 as well, where the phosphorylated form is P5P, pyridoxal 5-phosphate. So this is riboflavin 5-phosphate, and that's pyridoxal. And what it means is at the 5, the fifth bond, you're going to see that phosphorus group. But the idea is that you're giving it what it needs to put it back together, where if you just took the free form, then the body would have to scavenge to get the extra phosphorus groups and other chemical rings to put back on it. So studies do indicate that it is more beneficial to take those active forms, but it may seem counterintuitive when we see how it's break it down, put it together, break it down, put it together. But it's going to have to be broken down and put together anyway. Most of the flavins circulating in the blood are in the form of riboflavin, a little bit as FAD or FMN, but in the bloodstream, it's riboflavin. But once it's into the tissues, then it's going to be converted and used mostly as the FAD form. In the bloodstream, it has to be transported by proteins, and albumin is the primary one. And you'll see when you do blood testing on people, albumin is measured. So if we have low albumin, which is a transporter for a lot of nutrients, we have low delivery of those nutrients to the tissues. Then there's globulins that it becomes part of, and that's primarily immunoglobulins. So globulins related to the immune system, you know, our antibodies basically. And then also fibrinogen, which is a blood clotting protein. So the free riboflavin is transported from the bloodstream into the tissues by active transport. Again, it's a lot of energy expenditure here. And then the brain is the only one of the only tissues that takes it up as FAD. Most of the others pick up the free form, but the brain actually picks up the FAD form. So let's talk about the storage of riboflavin in the body. The highest quantities are found in the kidney, liver, and the heart. And it's really just small quantities, because like I said earlier, we really don't store our water-soluble B vitamins, with the exception of vitamin B12, which gets stored in the liver in quite high quantities. Really small amounts are found in most tissues, and the highest concentration in kidney, liver, and heart. They're the most metabolically active tissues, right? That's why. So mostly it's converted to FAD and FMN, the cofactor forms in the tissues. The synthesis, the creation of FAD and FMM is under hormonal control. So there's particular hormones that increase the activity of the enzyme that puts the whole thing together again, you know, kind of like Humpty Dumpty and putting them together again. We're taking the riboflavin and it comes apart and we put it back together again. So the hormones that are most involved there are ACTH, which is adrenal corticotrophic hormone, which actually stimulates the adrenals to produce its hormones, adrenaline and DHEA and cortisol. Thyroid hormone and aldosterone. And aldosterone is secreted again by the adrenals, and it controls the water, the fluid retention. It actually has its impact on the kidneys. Okay, so you can see that the hormones that control the riboflavin are hormones that are impacted by stress. So it makes sense why we call the B vitamins, and in particular, riboflavin is one of them, a stress hormone, right? Because it's impacted by our stress vitamin. So what about the metabolism and the excretion of riboflavin? Well, there's riboflavin binding proteins that are specific to pregnancy, and they're essential to normal fetal development. So it's really important that these specific binding proteins are there so that the fetus grows. So it's important that we have the proper amounts of nutrients during pregnancy for normal fetal development. The unbound flavins, the riboflavin itself versus the coenzyme forms, the FMN, are relatively labile, meaning they're sensitive and they can break down easily. They're rapidly hydrolyzed to free riboflavin, at which diffuses from the cells and is excreted. Okay, so we have these free unbound flavins, and they get hydrolyzed to the free riboflavin, which it can just diffuse out. It can just leak out and be excreted. So that's why they're mostly stored as the FAD and FNM forms. The phosphorylation, which happens inside the cells, we're thinking, this is what scientists are thinking, is something called metabolic trapping. So it's an ability to bind the riboflavin to these other rings so that it stays inside the cell so it doesn't leak out and get excreted. So they call it metabolic trapping of the phosphorus groups and of the riboflavin. Any excess of riboflavin is going to be excreted in the urine. It can be measured as riboflavin itself or a metabolite called 7-hydroxymethylriboflavin, okay, or lumiflavin. Okay, you don't need to memorize these. You don't need to know, but I love giving you the picture so you can just kind of like follow its journey through the body. Some of the urinary metabolites reflect bacterial activity in the intestinal tract. So it's the activity of the bacteria in the intestinal tract on the riboflavin that cause particular urinary metabolites. So what influences riboflavin absorption and conversion? So things that decrease it would be minerals that are called divalent minerals. They chelate it. They chelate the FMN and the riboflavin. Things like copper, zinc, manganese, and iron. So you've got to be careful about overdosing on these and taking superphysiologic doses unless you're also taking superphysiologic doses of riboflavin, because you can end up losing some of your riboflavin. Alcohol impairs both the digestion and the absorption of riboflavin. So kind of minimize that or eliminate that. One of the diseases that people who are really severe alcoholics get are vitamin B1 and B2 deficiencies. The other things that decrease the absorption of riboflavin: hypothyroidism, adrenal fatigue, elevated levels of homocysteine, and remember that from the methylation pathways, homocysteine is a byproduct of basically low folate and low vitamin B12, because there's not enough of those to carry through and convert homocysteine to methionine. And we'll look in detail about the homocysteine pathway and that whole methylation cycle when we look at vitamin B9 and also vitamin B12. And a little bit with vitamin B6. So some of the medications that can impact absorption are anticholinergic medications. So those affect the neuromuscular junctions. Methotrexate, which is used a lot in RA and cancer. Another one called probenecid. And then thiazide diuretics. So if you've got somebody who's on any of these medications or has a history of being on these medications, then you want to make sure to evaluate and hopefully supplement the riboflavin status. What seems to help increase riboflavin if you're taking a supplement is to take the supplement on an empty stomach. And if you take it along with some of these other vitamins and minerals, you'll get better absorption as well. So vitamin A, most of the B vitamins, B1, B3, B5, B6, biotin, folate, and B12. I would say that's all of the B vitamins. The minerals that increase absorption of riboflavin are chromium, copper, magnesium, phosphate, and potassium. Another thing that helps increase the absorption of riboflavin is glutathione, which is a potent antioxidant, sulfur-containing antioxidant, and cysteine, which is a sulfur-containing amino acid. Well, so now that we know how vitamin B2 or riboflavin gets into the system, and you'll see me interchangeably using the term vitamin B2 and riboflavin at the top of the slides, just to get you used to that. So there's some roles that are really super important here. One is the production of energy. It's important in the Krebs cycle. If you recall what we talked about in our energy metabolism, cellular metabolism module, we talked about the Krebs cycle. And in the picture of the Krebs cycle, we had all those little intermediates, and FAD was one of those. So very important there, and also in the electron transport chain. So all in the process of creating energy. It's important in antioxidants. It's important in the production of glutathione. It's needed for converting B6 and folate to its active forms. We have some slides on how that works. It's important for growth and repair. It's an important factor in methylation. And with methylation, we often think about vitamin B12 and folate, but B2 is required to recycle the folate. So if we're short on B2, you can get problems with methylation. And you may be giving someone folate or B12 and not seeing improvements until you give them the B2. Then thyroid function, it's very important in the conversion of thyroid hormones and in the cellular uptake. And then in red blood cell production, because as a part of that methylation pathway, we bring around the B12 and the folate into a position where they can get converted to the SAMe, and then the SAMe goes into this process of DNA repair. And we need that DNA for the production of red blood cells. So we see megaloblastic anemia, a condition of very large red blood cells, immature red blood cells, in B6, well, mostly B9, folate, and B12 anemia or deficiency, but we also can see it with B2 as a result of its interaction there at the methylation pathway. So let's look at some of the active coenzyme forms of riboflavin. One is FAD, flavin adenine dinucleotide. It's part of the Krebs cycle in the electron transport chain, so very important for creation of energy. It's a cofactor for MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, MTHFR. So it's a cofactor for that. It's also used for an enzyme called cyuranine 3-monooxygenase, and it converts tryptophan to niacin. So you can see that if you don't have enough B2, you don't have enough niacin, B3. It allows the recycling of glutathione, which is because it's a cofactor for glutathione reductase. And glutathione reductase is involved in the oxidation and reduction cycle of glutathione. FMN is flavin mononucleotide. We'll also see it listed as riboflavin 5-phosphate. It's the primary form of riboflavin that's found in cells and tissues. It requires more energy to produce, but it's more soluble than riboflavin. And it's involved in these oxidation-reduction reactions, oxidation-reduction. So we go from an oxidized form of something, we have an enzyme that takes it and reduces it back to the whole form, and then it gets oxidized again, and then it gets reduced, and that's called the redox reactions. And it's part of an enzyme called glutamate synthase, which helps the body to make glutamate from like glutamic acid. So let's take a quick look at flavoproteins. When FAD and FMN, the coenzyme forms of riboflavin, when they attach to proteins, we call them flavoproteins. They're mainly located where oxygen-based energy is needed. So they're mainly located in the heart and skeletal muscle, where there's a lot of oxygenation required. And there are 90 flavoproteins in the human genome. That's a lot. 90 flavoproteins. 84% of them require FAD, 16% require FMN, and only 5 of them require both. That's not 5%, that's actually 5. So let's talk about oxidation reduction. What exactly is that? Well, it's basically the reactions that involve the transfer of electrons. And that we know that that's what oxidation is, right? When something gets oxidized, it's losing electrons. It becomes unstable. The flavocoenzymes participate in redox reactions in several metabolic pathways, you know, including the glutathione reductase. It's critical for the metabolism of carbohydrates, lipids, and protein. We need redox reactions. So FAD is part of what's called the electron transport chain, the respiratory chain, that's central to energy production. So that's when you look at the Krebs cycle, I would review back to the Krebs cycle pictures and really get a sense of where you see the FAD participating. And then FAD participates in the metabolism of drugs and various toxins in conjunction with an enzyme system called cytochrome P450. And cytochrome P450 is very potent detoxification enzymes. Mostly found in the liver, but also found in the digestive tract and in other tissues throughout the body. So let's look at vitamin B2 and antioxidant function. These are three of our main antioxidant enzymes that vitamin B2 or riboflavin is involved in. So we have glutathione reductase, which is involved in the redox cycle of glutathione. So it takes the oxidized glutathione and converts it back to reduced glutathione, so it makes it available again for oxidation reactions. So we have oxidation, reduction, and we basically recycle our antioxidants that way. It also has a major role in protecting the body from reactive oxygen species like hydroperoxides. So these are very unstable molecules, and they're always looking to stabilize themselves by oxidizing our healthy body tissue. So glutathione reductase is important there. And then it requires FAD to regenerate two molecules of reduced glutathione from the oxidized. Without the FAD, without a riboflavin sufficiency, we're not going to get the full impact of our glutathione systems, which means that we're not going to get the protection. We use a lot of glutathione from after the Krebs cycle intermediates work. So you get this whole Krebs cycle, and it produces a lot of oxidation byproducts. And glutathione is paramount in getting that stuff broken down. We also have glutathione peroxidases. So these are two different types of enzymes. These enzymes contain the mineral selenium. And we require two molecules of reduced glutathione to break down the hydroperoxides. And again, this one's also involved in the glutathione oxidation reduction cycle. And the last of these antioxidants that I want to talk about today is the xanthine oxidase, which catalyzes the oxidation of hypoxanthine and xanthine to uric acid. So if we have a low level of B2, we might also see a low level of uric acid. So whenever you're looking at somebody's blood levels, usually we have a flag raised when their levels of uric acid are high, because uric acid can form crystals in the kidneys and lead to kidney stones, and also in the big toe and other joints, and lead to the formation of gout. So we usually look for, the uric acid is high, but if the uric acid is low, it could indicate that there's a problem with riboflavin. Okay, riboflavin deficiency can result in decreased uric acid. So if you're looking at somebody's labs and you see, uric acid levels are low, and you redo it a few months later, uric acid levels are still low. I wonder if they have a riboflavin deficiency. So let's take a look at some of these oxidation reduction cycles. So in this picture, we have at the top, we have reduced glutathione. And the glutathione, in order to get oxidized, goes through the glutathione peroxidase. And that's a selenium-dependent enzyme. So we take the reduced glutathione and take it down to oxidize by going through this glutathione peroxidase selenium-dependent enzyme. Produces hydrogen peroxide and water as byproduct. We then take the oxidized glutathione and put it through an enzyme called glutathione reductase, which is FAD-dependent enzyme, and we convert it back to the reduced form. So let's take a look at a few different disease states and conditions that riboflavin is involved with. One of them is cataracts. There have been some studies that show that B2, riboflavin, might help prevent cataracts, might help prevent the damage to the lens of the eye that cataracts cause, and it causes cloudy vision. We see this a lot in older people, but it's not a normal part of aging. It's just a common part of aging, and we have to differentiate. And it could be related to their vitamin mineral status their whole life. Many people are they're on the standard American diet, their B vitamins are shot because all of the foods, the processed foods, have the B vitamins removed, and just synthetic form, small amounts put back in. So a lot of people are deficient in B vitamins. They're eating a lot of sugar, which requires more of the utilization of the Krebs cycle to create energy, but it doesn't provide more of the nutrients. So you become deficient when you're eating a high sugar, high processed food diet, especially in B vitamins. So that may be one of the contributing factors to why we see so many older people getting cataracts. There are some few studies that I quoted here, a double-blind placebo-controlled study, putting niacin and riboflavin supplementation together. That group had less cataracts than the people who took other vitamins or nutrients. And they weren't able in that particular study to differentiate whether it was the niacin or the riboflavin or the synergy between them. We see a decreased risk of age-related cataracts from 33% to 51% reduced in men and women in the highest dietary riboflavin intake. So the ones that had the highest levels of intake of riboflavin actually had the lowest risk. And it's called a prospective or retrospective study. It's not actually doing something and putting people on a specific thing. We're just observing. It's an observational study. So individuals in the highest quintile, which means the highest fifth of riboflavin status, as measured by red blood cell glutathione reductase activity, which we'll see is a really good measure of riboflavin status, they had about half the occurrence of the cataracts as those in the lowest. So the top fifth and the bottom fifth, we compared them and they actually had half the amount of cataracts in that top fifth. So there is a connection here. Whether we've proven it, double-blind placebo-controlled, proven it to be, beyond the shadow of a doubt, but we don't really need to wait for things to be absolutely proven when there's not really a risk of helping people to achieve optimal vitamin status. There was also a study in Australia, which was 2,900 Australian men and women, 49 and older, and the ones that were in the highest quintile of riboflavin intake were 50% less likely to have cataracts than those in the lowest. Well, that's the same as the other study. So there's two different studies that talked about this. that was actually more of a study than just an observational. So there's just definitely evidence, more research has to be done. But then there's the specific light-induced damage to the lens, the proteins in the lens, can lead to development. So we can, you know, just be careful about the exposure of the eyes, but the riboflavin may be protecting it. And that's where riboflavin's role in vision comes in. And the studies, all of these studies were listed on this page that I've given you the link to, the Linus Pauling Institute. They have very good information about vitamins and minerals. So let's look at the relationship between riboflavin and cardiovascular disease. Riboflavin acts as a cofactor for MTHFR. We know methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, which is related to the methylation of folate and the methylation cycle. So any of the problems that we get from low folate can also be vitamin B2. So what happens is we need the riboflavin to generate the 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, 5-MTHF, for remethylation of the homocysteine to methionine. So we'll look at that pathway in more detail in the B9 and the B12 talks, but you'll see that the body is trying to take homocysteine and convert it back to methionine. When that doesn't happen, when you have either a deficiency of B2, B6, B12, or folate, we get a buildup of homocysteine. And homocysteine can be toxic to a lot of different things in the body. It can be toxic to the blood vessel linings. It can be toxic to the nerves. And so it's associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And what we found is that people with the MTHFR SNP, that their blood pressure, more of those people with that had blood pressure above 140 over 90. So when we look at the general population versus the population with the MTHFR SNP, there's a higher incidence of hypertension, which could lead to a higher incidence of stroke. So all of these things play in to the cardiovascular disease. So the methionine, the increase in the methionine, and then the increase in the blood pressure as a result, all of this can be related to a B2 deficiency. Doesn't mean it's only related to, but it's something you have to take into account when you're dealing with somebody who's either got a family history or personal history of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, stroke, heart attack, any of those things. Okay. They found that when you take people that have high blood pressure and they're homozygous for the MTHFR SNP, which means that they got a copy of the bad guy gene from the mom and the copy of the bad guy gene from the dad, they're very responsive to getting their blood pressure down with low-dose riboflavin. And low-dose riboflavin is considered under 20 milligrams, sometimes even under 10 milligrams. So very small doses go a long way. Riboflavin can be associated with cancer. Again, let's go back to that MTHFR SNP. That MTHFR, when somebody has impairment in that whole cycle of methylation, it can affect the body all over. And the connection between cancer and the MTHFR is the fact that we don't get adequate methylation of the DNA and repair of the DNA. And when we have a situation where the MTHFR is problematic, we're not regenerating SAMe, which is the primary methyl donor, then DNA repair and production suffers. And it's those changes in the structure and function of the DNA that happen during cancer production that we don't get the protection from. And so that's why we can have an increased risk of cancer when we have an MTHFR SNP, and vitamin B2 can actually cause that enzyme not to work as well. So even if we don't have the MTHFR SNP, if we have low B2, we're having inefficient use of that enzyme. So let's see. So folate deficiency along with this and elevated homocysteine concentrations have been shown to be causative or correlative with increased cancer risk. And then when you look at that MTHFR, you basically look at a SNP. It's basically, it's called single nucleotide polymorphism. We go through a lot more detail in part of this program. But the SNP basically means that there's a particular substitution. So when you look at the 677T, when you see MTHFR 677T, it means in position 677, there's a cytosine that's substituted with a thymine. basically it's one of the nucleotides is substituted for another. And so the cytosine is substituted for thymine, which makes the gene not function properly, which makes you have lower levels of the enzyme, the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme that it codes for. And that affects the binding of this flavin dinucleotide. Okay, and then as a result, that genotype may be at risk for higher risk of cancer. So anybody that has this MTHFR issue that and you're adding folate to their regime, think about adding riboflavin as well. We have a lot of folks out there, a lot of doctors are out there on this MTHFR bandwagon and say, oh yeah, let's just run a test. And they run a test where they just test two different variations of MTHFR. But they don't look at all the other genes in the pathway. And as a result, they may say, oh, this person needs folate because they have an MTHFR SNP. And they give the person folate, but then sometimes they feel worse because they're not taking into account the rest of the genes. And sometimes they just don't get better. So these are some of the things to look into. And we'll go into way more detail on that when we talk detailed methylation. So migraine headaches and B2, what's the role? Well, when we have impaired mitochondrial oxygen metabolism in the brain, that can cause migraine headaches. So because riboflavin is the precursor of FAD and FMN in the mitochondrial electron transport chain, we don't get as much oxygenation and flow and energy to the brain. Okay, so when they've done studies where they took riboflavin and supplemented it with people with migraines, there was a reduction in frequency and duration. Now, this isn't 100% across the board because migraines can be caused by lots of different things. But there are enough studies out there to show that if you've got somebody who's dealing with migraines, that B2 might be something to consider. There was a double-blind placebo-controlled study that showed that taking 400 milligrams of riboflavin a day cut the number of migraine attacks in half. Now, if you've got migraines, you know, I'll take it. But then there are folks that it doesn't work with and it could make them worse. I worked with somebody and I knew her genetics. We looked at stuff and I was working with her on headaches. And I said, well, let's just give this vitamin B2 a try and see if it makes a difference. It made her worse. So we kind of dug in there and we found out some other things about her pathways that explained it. But you don't know that if you just start dumping supplements on and expecting a result. So you always have to be aware when somebody takes a supplement that you've recommended or that seems to be indicated, that they go slowly, they move up very gradually in dose, they don't start out with the full dose, and you watch for symptoms, adverse symptoms. And if there's adverse symptoms, then you see if you can figure out why, or you at least back off. So let's look at autism. If you know anybody that's has a kid that's autistic, you know what a challenge that is to raise a child who has, it's like they're trapped in this paradigm that just kind of gets in the way of them fitting into life. But, you know, from their perspective, they're not necessarily that bad off. They're living in their own world. They're not willing to make concessions and come into our world. But it can be a challenge for the parents and it can be a challenge for the child as well because there's a lot of other physiologic things that go along with it. Well, with vitamin B2 is related to fat metabolism. And when you supplement with riboflavin along with carnitine and copper, you can actually see some improvements in people with autism because there is a problem with fat metabolism usually. A lot of times kids on a CoQ10 because there's certain, they do an organic acids test and there's certain indications. But from my research, it seems that if you are going to do that and put them on CoQ10, make sure you start them off with riboflavin. The other thing is when you take the B2 and you supplement the B6 and magnesium with it, it's been shown to reduce levels of what's called dicarboxylic acid, which is an abnormal organic acid on the testing. And that's been found to be elevated in the urine of autistic children. Also, there's something called very long chain fatty acids. Like we know that we have short chain fatty acids, which are butyrate and others, acetate, that are in the colon. And they're very important for the health of the colonic cells. Then we have the medium chain triglycerides, things that are found in things like coconut oil and palm oil. And caprylic acid is one of the shorter of those medium chain triglycerides. It's around an 8 carbon. And then we have these others called very long chain fatty acids. And these have been found to be in the blood of autistic children to be elevated. And when we supplement with B2, we found that those can be reduced. So they may play a role in some of the patterns that the autistic community deals with. The other thing that's related to autism is that the B2, as we talked about earlier, takes part in the conversion of tryptophan into niacin and in the synthesis of the body's anti-inflammatory substances. So we can help reduce inflammation indirectly through supplementation with riboflavin. So what are some of the things that deplete riboflavin? Well, drugs mostly. There's mostly medications on here. The tricyclic antidepressants, and there's a list of those, the imipramine and desimipramine and amitriptyline and noratriptyline. These are all things that can deplete B2. And it just brings back that I say over and over is when you're working with somebody, get a good drug history. Not just what they're taking now, but what have they taken over the last couple of years? Or what have certainly what they've taken in the period since their symptoms started to develop? Because they can deplete vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, amino acids. It's really important to stay on top of that. There's some antipsychotic medications like chlorpromazine and then thorazine. And then there's these other medications for a variety of different things. Doxorubicin, phenytoin, which is the same as dilantin, thiazide diuretics. It's often given people, they call them water pills. Anticholinergic medications, which have to do with the junctions between the nerves and the muscles. And then alcohol, which is definitely, I think, a drug, and people can misuse it. And I'm not saying that an occasional glass of wine every few months is going to be problematic for people's health, but I think that that ongoing long-term usage of it is definitely for sure. So what are some of the interactions in addition to the medications we just mentioned? Tetracycline, riboflavin actually interferes with its absorption and effectiveness. So if somebody's trying to take tetracycline for an infection and they're also taking high-dose vitamin B2, that may be a problem. Methotrexate actually interferes with how the body uses riboflavin. And that's used oftentimes for RA and for cancer therapy. So just make sure that you're asking questions. And the probenecid decreases the absorption of riboflavin from the digestive tract and also increases urinary loss. And that's actually used to treat gout. So what are some of our risk factors for vitamin B2? Well, we talked about alcohol. With alcoholics, we see a decreased intake because a lot of times they're just not bothering with food. They're just drinking. A decreased absorption because of the effect of alcohol on the cells that line the digestive tract. And impaired utilization of riboflavin. So alcohol is not so good for vitamin B2 status. Anorexia, you know, that's where people are just not eating enough calories. They're not eating enough. And so most of their nutrients are going to suffer. Lactose intolerance is considered one. And that's mainly because there's decent amounts of riboflavin found in milk and people with lactose intolerance don't eat it. So I'm not sure if the correlation goes beyond that. Also hypothyroid and adrenal fatigue. So the conversion of riboflavin into FAD and FMN is impaired in these conditions. And then if you take very physically active people like athletes and laborers, they're gonna have a slightly increased riboflavin requirement. So you have to make sure that you're allowing for that and explaining to them that they have to do more of that. So let's look at some of the interactions of the other B complexes with riboflavin. Well, we need the flavoproteins for the metabolism of B6, niacin, and folate. So if we are low in B2 and riboflavin, we might also show signs of B6, niacin, and folate imbalances. When there's a severe riboflavin deficiency, it can affect many enzyme systems related to these nutrients. So the conversion of B6 to its coenzyme form P5P, which is similar to the way the body does it with the riboflavin, is an FMN-dependent enzyme. Okay, and the name of that enzyme is pyridoxine 5' phosphate oxidase. The synthesis of niacin-containing coenzymes like NAD and NADP, which are also involved in the Krebs cycle, by the way, they come from the amino acid tryptophan. It's an FAD-dependent enzyme, chirine monooxygenase. So it's amazing how these things all interact with each other, isn't it? Severe riboflavin deficiency can decrease the conversion of tryptophan to niacin, or NAD and NADP, which affects this cycle. And then MTHFR happens to be an FAD-dependent enzyme. So the higher riboflavin intakes are associated with lower plasma homocysteine. So anybody that has a high homocysteine, one of the things you can look at is their level of riboflavin. Let's take a look and see how iron interacts with riboflavin. A riboflavin deficiency can impair iron absorption. It can increase the intestinal loss of iron, and it can impair iron utilization for making hemoglobin. When we improve the riboflavin status, it's found to increase the circulating hemoglobin levels, which could result in better energy, better healing, better oxygenation, better sports performance. A lot of things implicated here. Riboflavin improves the response of an iron deficiency anemia to iron therapy when riboflavin is deficient. So in other words, if you have someone who's deficient in iron and you decide to put that person on iron supplementation, if they also have a riboflavin deficiency, the iron supplementation is not going to work that well. So it's important to either test to see or just assume and give decent-sized doses of riboflavin. It could be part of a B-complex. This is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study done in pregnant women with anemia in Southeast Asia. It showed that a combination of folate, iron, vitamin A, and riboflavin improved hemoglobin levels and decreased anemia prevalence compared to the iron folic acid supplementation alone. So this is saying that it's more than just, we're not going to be try to be reductionistic and say things break down to just this one nutrient or this one deficiency, that everything's working together. So the RDIs, I'm not going to read every one of these, but these are basically the recommended daily intakes. And we see that it goes from 0.3 birth up to 0.4 at a year. And then it doesn't go up much in there, except when we get into teenage years. So children all the way up to 13 are still in the percentage of a milligram, whereas when we get to be an adult, we're starting to need a lot more, like females needing one and then males needing 1.3. Still not a lot. This is a milligram, which is about 100 micrograms. Once we get into adults 19 and over, it pretty much stays the same. The only time it changes is with pregnancy and breastfeeding. And that's where they're the highest. What are some common things you will see when vitamin B2 riboflavin is deficient? Well, the reason for the deficiency is because if you don't have it in the diet consistently, it's going to be peed away and it's not stored. So it really is an important one to make sure people are getting on a daily basis. I always prefer food first. But if somebody's deficient, has any of these problems, then I would certainly look at doing the supplementation along with the food. Riboflavin deficiency is almost always accompanied by a deficiency of other vitamins. It doesn't usually occur in isolation. And that's because, you know, I guess the kinds of foods and places where you get it from are similar. So we have a couple of different types of riboflavin deficiency. One is primary, one is secondary. Primary is just they're eating a diet that's depleted of vitamin B2, doesn't have enough of it. On secondary, it could be a result of poor absorption, utilization, increase in the excretion. Riboflavin as a deficiency can result in decreased xanthine oxidase activity, which is one of its coenzymes, but that will reduce the blood uric acid levels, as we said before. And we've said this before, that the severe niacin deficiency can impact the conversion of tryptophan to niacin. Let's move on to some of the signs and symptoms. We've looked at a few disease states that have been correlated with low vitamin B2, but those are not the general. We're usually going to see some vague signs that you can pull together and decide if it's worthwhile to supplement with a certain nutrient or get concentrated whole food sources. The signs and symptoms of vitamin B2 deficiency, riboflavin deficiency, angular chelosis. So if you look at your person and you have where the top and bottom lip come together, there's a little corner there. When that gets cracked, it starts to look irritated or inflamed. That could be a sign of B2 deficiency. You can also have cracked lips and inflammation in the mouth, on the lining of the mouth, the tongue. We've got a lot of things that happen with the mouth and the skin with the vitamin B2. So we have the angular chelosis, which is cracks at the corner of the mouth. They can have cracked lips. They may have scaly, kind of moist skin inflammation that's kind of like a seborrhea, only it's on the body. Seborrheic dermatitis. Seborrhea is usually on the scalp. Inflammation of the lining of the mouth and the tongue. Ulcers in the mouth. And most could be on the cheek, on the inside cheek. You reach in and there's ulcers there. Sometimes those happen from people biting themselves. So you need to differentiate. Swelling and soreness of the throat. Fatigue. Slowed digestion. Any kind of digestive issues. And then if there's iron deficiency or megaloblastic anemia. Why? Because of the interactions with folate, vitamin B12, but also with the iron. So you can go either way, or you can have it look just fine, but be off. And they also might be sensitive to bright light, fatigued, itchy eyes, things like that. So let's take a look at vitamin B2, riboflavin, and a condition called preeclampsia. And preeclampsia is a condition that happens in pregnancy, usually in the last trimester. And it's a syndrome that incorporates a combination of elevated blood pressure, protein in the urine, and edema. It's considered pretty serious because about 5% of those women with preeclampsia will progress to something called eclampsia, which is more severe, and it can actually cause death in mom and the fetus. Eclampsia can involve seizures, very high blood pressure, and increased risk of hemorrhaging. So it's something that is really looked at very carefully in that last part of pregnancy, and everybody's screened for it. And people are given, you know, a variety of different things to try to help. Magnesium tends to be a really good thing to do. But what's found was that riboflavin is also really, really something that can be helpful. So he took a study of 154 pregnant women at increased risk of preeclampsia. And the ones that were riboflavin had 4.7 times the risk of developing preeclampsia than those with adequate. So when you looked at these women, the ones that had adequate riboflavin were that much less at risk for preeclampsia. We're not really sure. The causes aren't really clear. It's possibly that decreased levels of those flavocoenzymes, the FAD and FMN, could cause the mitochondrial dysfunction or could increase oxidative stress and interfere with nitric oxide release and cause blood vessel dilation. There's a lot of theories. They did a meta-analysis of 51 women. The ones with the C677T, was associated with preeclampsia. And this was done in Caucasian and East Asian populations. And there is some surmising that perhaps it is related to ethnicity. But what happens if you take too much B2? Well, there's not really a known toxicity level for riboflavin. The excess is going to be easily excreted in the urine, and you'll have that bright yellow urine. There are some reactions that some people have at very high doses, like itching, numbness, burning or prickling sensation, or sensitivity to light. And then when they lowered the dose back down to normal dose, those symptoms go away. Doses that go above 10 milligrams a day can cause eye damage from the sun. And people who are taking higher dose niacin should be protecting their eyes with sunglasses that have UV protection to decrease that risk. And then extra riboflavin over and above what we don't need can increase the risk of DNA damage. So let's look at how do we assess. How do we know if a person has enough vitamin B2 or not? Well, the gold standard is the measurement of the glutathione reductase activity in red blood cells. The erythritite glutathione reductase activity coefficient is called EGRAC. And that measures the activity of the glutathione reductase before and after reactivation with FAD. The ratio is calculated as the ratio of the FAD-stimulated to unstimulated enzyme activity. And it indicates the degree of tissue saturation with riboflavin. So if there's not a whole lot of difference between the two, that would mean that the tissues are saturated. And if there is a difference between the two, it could indicate that there's not quite enough riboflavin, so it gets active when we test it this way. Then there's another way to do it, is a simpler way, is urinary riboflavin excretion. You know, excretion studies are decent for measuring levels of things, but it's basically measuring what your body's getting rid of. So if you go on the theory that the body's getting rid of the excess that it doesn't need, then you can certainly look at if there's a lot of urinary excretion of a certain substance, then the body probably has plenty of it and it doesn't need that. On the other hand, it could be a problem with the absorption. It could be a problem with the transport and the storage. But that's decent. It's not too bad. Another one is organic acid. There's a metabolic acid called superate, and it's a fatty acid, and riboflavin actually helps to metabolize those fatty acids. So when we see a buildup of superate in the urine of somebody when you do an organic acid test, that could indicate that there's low riboflavin. So let's have a look at food sources of vitamin B2, of riboflavin. Most people get enough of it, although a lot of people on the standard American diet don't necessarily, because they're eating a lot of the processed foods, which are devoid. So on the plant-based side, there's brewis, yeast, almonds, whole grains, wheat germ, wild rice, mushrooms, soybeans, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, spinach. On the animal side, there's organ meats, milk, yogurt, and eggs. Well, milk, yogurt, and eggs are all high on the allergen list, so I'm not usually going to put somebody on those if they have issues, if they have energy issues or other kinds of health issues. So let's look at food preparation that actually affects vitamin B2. It's destroyed by light. So if you have a bottle of riboflavin in a capsule or powder or liquid, you want to make sure it's in a dark container. If your various foods, you don't want to have them out. If they're high riboflavin foods, you don't want to have them out in the light. They're not so much destroyed by heat, which is unusual for a water-soluble B vitamin. Usually the water solubles are destroyed by heat. It can be lost in water when foods are boiled or soaked. So if you are boiling vegetables and then throwing away the water, then you might be losing a lot of the riboflavin. But if you're making soup, on the other hand, and you're drinking the water or soaking something in and saving the water, then you could maintain quite a bit of the B2. This is a chart taken from the WH Foods. I've given you the link. WH Foods has charts like this for just about any nutrient. It's a really good idea to just kind of take a look at people's diet diaries and compare them to some of these sources, because if they're not getting enough, they may be having symptoms of the low riboflavin. There's some herbs that are high in vitamin B2. There's quite a number of them. Paprika, parsley, chili powder, coriander, spearmint, tarragon, basil, fenugreek, fennel, dill weed, celery seed, mustard seed, turmeric, and rosemary. And then how do we supplement? Well, there's a number of ways that you can supplement B2, riboflavin. It's usually included in a multi, so if you get a good multi, it's going to be there, whether it's a liquid multi, a powdered multi, or a capsule. And it's complex with other B vitamins. Another way you can get it is just as straight old riboflavin. You can also get it as riboflavin 5 monophosphate or riboflavin 5 phosphate. Phosphate sodium is what it often says. So those are active forms. It's either that you get the single form or the active form. I usually recommend using the activated forms, because even if they are broken down, and some of it might be excreted depending on the gradient, you can actually buy riboflavin in any number of variety of capsules, 25 milligrams, 50, even 100 milligrams capsules or tablets. And it's also available in liquid form. There's a company over in Europe, in England, I believe, called Metabolics, that sells a lot of these individual B vitamins in a liquid form. And then there's other, like Premier Research Labs has some as well. So, you know, just kind of check around and play with it with people to see what is the form that's going to help them the most. There you have it. There are our references. We do a lot of reference work from the Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism book. That's our official textbook. If you haven't gotten it, there's a link on the site where we talk about it. But basically, I would recommend you go to the Amazon Marketplace. The book is in 7th edition now. I've got the 4th edition. And the 7th edition, if you buy it off Amazon, is $200 and something. And the 4th edition, if you buy it, is around $25. So I don't think there's that much of a difference that for our purposes. So save yourself money. But it is a great book to have because it's a great reference. It shows a lot of charts. And it's definitely a textbook, but it's got some good stuff in it. Okay, so there's a bunch of other things that we have down here as far as references, and that's where we've quoted a variety of things from this presentation. So thank you for being here and really listening in to find out more about vitamin B2 or riboflavin. I know sometimes it can get bogged down by being deep into the chemistry, But I think that having been exposed to it and thinking it through, it makes a lot more sense when you're looking at people to see if they have specific nutrient deficiencies, because you kind of are getting it. You start to get it. So thank you so much for being here. And that's the end of our riboflavin presentation.